This last session is so important, I think. It's beyond important. It's critical in our society. It's critical in our relationships with one another. Unfortunately, it's critical within the Lord's body today just because of the nature of things. I would ask you this, and this is the way I always start this session. How many of you in here know somebody who has had an adulterous relationship? Anybody at all? How many of you know a Christian that's had an adulterous relationship? Now, not really a great reduction in the amount of hands, is there, when that happens? How many of you know a Christian that's had an adulterous relationship and it has thereby severed and ruined the marriage? That's heartbreaking, isn't it? That's sad. That shouldn't happen. We know that shouldn't happen. We know that's not the Lord's desire for us. We know it's not His plan. We need to make sure that we are doing everything we can to prevent that from happening. We need to do everything we can to make sure that we stand true to the Lord, to make sure that we're doing what God asks us to do. And I know this session, when you raise your hands like that, unfortunately, that typically even means that there are people within the group that has raised their hands that have been affected directly by that. And that's painful and that's hard. If you're in that situation and you're here, I am truly sorry that is the case. But it doesn't make the topic any less important. Matter of fact, it may make it more important so that we can understand, what do we do about that? Surely we are not just victims of our society and just have to let this happen around us. I don't believe that that's true. I believe God has told us that we can, if we choose to, live the kinds of lives that He says that we ought to live. And so I want us to look at this particular lesson this afternoon, affair-proofing your marriage, and I almost hesitate to call it that. There's a word called a circumlocution. You know what a circumlocution is? You know, we don't use that very often. If you're not in college and haven't had that as a recent vocabulary word, or you don't do Reader's Digest, or you're not a teacher, you may not know that. But a circumlocution is a word that kind of skirts its way around another word or concept. In other words, very similar to a euphemism in that sense. In other words, we say somebody has passed on instead of saying that somebody has died, because saying somebody's died just doesn't sound as good. And that's even a biblical concept. You remember Jesus said of Lazarus that he's asleep, even though he was dead. The disciples didn't understand what he meant. He had a point to make about that, but we use circumlocutions. Affair is a circumlocution. And even though this marriage says affair-proofing your marriage, or this lesson says affair-proofing your marriage, I think it's important we think of it in the terms that it is, that it's a violation of the trust that God has put in us and that we have put in Him and our spouse, that it is an adulterous relationship. It's not an affair. You know, I think of an affair, you think of things like an affair to remember, you know, movie titles and things of that nature. It makes it sound almost pleasant. Nothing pleasant. Nothing pleasant about this situation. We know that. So what does God expect us to do? Anybody tell me what that is? It's a cancer. No question about that. That is a cancer. That's actually a breast cancer that's being described there, an invasive or infiltrating ductal carcinoma. But the overall thing there is a pathology report. In other words, a doctor, when he does a biopsy, sends that sample out to some lab, and they send back a report similar to this. It's a pathology report. And this tells the doctor a lot of different things. It tells them exactly what they were looking at. They were looking at a complete excision. That means it wasn't a needle biopsy. It was a complete removal of the tissue that was in question here. And so it talks about a tumor size, a histological type, that it's invasive ductal, meaning it wasn't contained any longer. It had actually spread out of the duct itself. That it has a grade. They score those things based on points. Extent of invasion, which is the overall concept of the tumor in that place. There were no margins that were involved. In other words, he's just saying, the sample that you sent us was completely clean in the margins, so that you got all that was there in that one particular sample, at least. That it was estrogen receptor positive, which is 89%. That's favorable. Bad when the tumor is in you. Good when they find it, because it's easier to treat. Progestin receptor positive. That it was HER2 negative, or within normal limits, which is good. P53 favorable. No lymph nodes involved. They did lymph node surgery as well, and an axillary dissection. No lymph nodes involved. No metastasis involved, which means they hadn't seen that it had spread to any other tissue tissue besides the tissue that was there. At least none that they could see had been determined. So they give this report, which is actually why it says MO instead of NO. In other words, it's saying they didn't see any, but they can't tell you that that's an absolute fact. You know, as opposed to when they check the lymph nodes, they say, absolutely, there was none in any of the lymph nodes. We can't tell you if there's anything else, and so it's labeled as an MO instead of an NO. Nothing that they could see. Why is that important, though? What does a pathology report serve the purpose of? In other words, why does the doctor even want that? He took an excision biopsy, he removed some tissue, sent it off. They sent him this back for what purpose? For decision-making. Because he's going to have to make a determination as to what does he do, isn't he? How does he treat this? Because it's a cancer, he's going to have numerous considerations. Is there going to have to be additional surgery that is involved? He has to make that decision. Somebody does, don't they? Is there going to have to be chemotherapy treatments? Is there going to have to be radiation treatments? Is there going to be some kind of medication treatments? What do you do? Somebody has to decide that. That's the purpose of a pathology report, isn't it? When you get any path report sent off, isn't that when you go and get a physical? There's a reason. The only reason the doctor wants to know what your cholesterol level is, it's not just for curiosity, huh? He's got a 280 cholesterol level. That's interesting to know. He wants to know that so he can tell you, you better cut this out of your diet, or you better take this pill, or whatever the case. He's trying to give you a method of correcting whatever the issue is. Isn't that right? Well, I want us to look at that biblically, because that's how we're going to approach this. We're going to look at the pathology of an affair first. The pathology of an adulterous relationship. What brings it about? Why is that important? Because if I understand how it comes about, then I can understand how do I combat it. Because God will help me to understand. And one passage we'll look at in Proverbs specifically, God's going to say, here are the things that you must do to prevent this from happening. He gives us an outline on that. He lays it out and says, you know, we talked about in our first lesson, having a goal. I have as a goal that I want to be faithful all my life to my wife. Not only have that as a goal, I made that as a promise, but I have that as a goal in my marriage. And so now, how do I accomplish that goal? I've got to have a plan. It's not going to just happen. It's not going to happen just because I say, you know what? I'm not going to be unfaithful, therefore it's not going to happen. I have to have a plan, and that's what we're going to talk about. What does God give us as a plan? Well, first, understanding the pathology itself. Vulnerability is the first step to having a relationship outside of the marital relationship. We become vulnerable. What kind of things make you vulnerable? Not having your needs met. In other words, I feel unfulfilled. In my relationship, I become more vulnerable, do I not? Automatically, that is the case. That's almost the same as when should you, in fact, go shopping, they tell you. Grocery shopping. Should you go grocery shopping when you're hungry? Bad idea, because you're going to pick the wrong stuff up because you're more vulnerable, aren't you? Hunger makes you vulnerable in that sense. So does lack of fulfillment in our marriage. Makes us vulnerable. Other things that make you vulnerable. I'm sorry, what? The environment we're in. If we're around the wrong kind of people, if we're in the wrong kind of place, we're in the wrong situation, we become more vulnerable. No question about that. Other things. Opportunities that are provided to us. All of a sudden, something that wouldn't have been presented before is presented. Now I become more vulnerable to that just because it is there. Stress makes us more vulnerable. Maybe things just, it's not that I'm unfulfilled at home. Maybe it's just that things are very stressful at home or things are very stressful at work. And so we seek some means of relieving that stress. Other things. We've been hurt. We become more vulnerable because somebody has offended us or hurt us. We're angry at them. We're frustrated with them, whatever the case may be. Other things that make you more vulnerable. I'm sorry, what? Lack of hedges. We haven't planted protection around ourselves. We haven't set ourselves up. If you look at the idea of somebody trying to come in and conquer you, which is what Satan's trying to do, like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour, the Bible describes these wonderful situations of cities that had walls around them. If the wall wasn't around the city, how much more vulnerable is the city? The wall is what protected the city, wasn't it? And so it's the same way with us. We've got to have hedges. We've got to have walls around us. We'll talk a little bit about that as we get further along. I'm sorry, what? TV and anything associated with that, the exposure to things of that kind of nature make us more vulnerable. It breaks down our senses. It wants us or creates in us desires that aren't the wholesome desires that God would have. And so you become more vulnerable because of that. One more that I'm really looking for and don't feel bad because this one's missed in almost every one. We don't typically think of it. I'm sorry, what? Loneliness is certainly one of those. We feel lonely. It's not necessarily just an unfulfilled, but we just feel alone. We're seeking some kind of companionship and attention. What about 1 Corinthians chapter 10 when it says, let those who what take heed? You remember? Lest they fall. You think you stand. Those who think they stand. Let me ask you this. There's several football games going on this weekend again as the NFL is in its playoffs or basketball games, things of that nature. Do you think there were, as you look back on this previous year, or maybe even in college more, think there's any teams that lost a college game this year because they were overconfident and looked ahead? I think absolutely that happened. People think you're going to stand. They think they're okay. They think they're not going to fall. That makes you more vulnerable. That's what Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. The one who thinks he stands, you better take heed. You better pay attention. You better watch out because you're subject to fall. Overconfidence is a big part of that as well. Peggy Vaughn said, preventing affairs is not like having a one-time inoculation or even getting occasional booster shots. It's more like taking a pill every day for the rest of your life. You know, you watch commercials, the commercials right now for a drug called Boniva. Some women here may be familiar with that drug, Boniva. It is for osteoporosis. And the big selling point of that drug is what? Anybody ever seen the commercials? The big selling point of Boniva. One time a month instead of once a week, like Actonel and the other drugs. And so, you know, imagine what it would be like if they said, hey, we've got a pill that you can take once and you never have to worry about osteoporosis. It's done. You don't have to worry. How attractive would that be for women? You know, or any other pill that worked that way. It would be just as attractive if somebody said, hey, let me tell you this. If you'll just do this today, you don't ever have to worry about having an adulterous relationship. Just take care of this today. It won't work that way. It's like having to take an inoculation or taking a pill every single day. It's like having to make sure I'm working on the same things over and over and over again and putting them into place. I can tell you that particular pathology report, that particular patient, as with the case of most breast cancer patients, takes a pill every single day because of that. That's the case. It'd be nice if the doctor said, hey, we're done. Don't worry about it anymore. You don't have to take anything else. Doesn't work that way. In his book, Torn Asunder, Dave Carter wrote these words. He said, when we are vulnerable, we are emotionally run down. Our defenses are down. Our perspective on things is clouded. We're not able to make judgments based on truth, and everything is seen through an emotional filter. Pain is intensified. Therefore, the pursuit of relief from pain is also intensified. When you are vulnerable, a situation that might otherwise be safe is now unsafe. That's the nature of vulnerability. You put yourself in a position where you might have been able to stand at other times, but because of your vulnerability, you're not able to stand. That's usually the first step. Secondly, there is an emotional involvement that comes along, non-physical involvement. This is the part of the affair or this relationship where people think they're still within the bounds of what is right. They don't think they've crossed the line yet. It's kind of the game-playing arrangement, the things that are said, the actions, but there's no physical involvement yet. People think that because there's no physical contact, they feel safe. They feel they're walking within the boundary, but they have already crossed this line. There are emotional intimacy issues that would indicate I've already crossed the line. What might some of those be? Violations of the boundary before there is physical contact. Intimate discussions, absolutely. There are things that I'm discussing with somebody of the opposite sex that I've got no business discussing with that person. Things sometimes, as I even listen to a husband or wife say, I was talking about this to them, it wasn't even something they'd ever shared with their husband or their wife. I'm sharing things with somebody else that I should be sharing only with my spouse, and I'm sharing that with somebody else. So intimate discussions, other things. I'm sorry, what? Flirtation, absolutely. A little look here, there, a comment that's made here, something that's suggestive or something that just indicates I'm not really asking you blatantly if you want to get involved, but there's that kind of, it's like a feeling out process, isn't it? where people are just, let's try and find out where everybody stands. I've got my intentions. Let's find out where everybody else stands in here. Other things. Pornography, and we'll get into that in a moment specifically, but pornography is certainly, and I'm talking about involvement with the other person here, but pornography is certainly a huge part of this issue, as we'll see in a minute. Yeah, and so there's an emotional involvement because I'm having some kind of meetings with that person in a very private setting. It's something that is just the two of us, and we'll talk about that as well. I'm sorry, what? The thought process that is going on in our minds. No question. We know when we can be involved and it's possible to be involved. One particular man was talking to me, he's talking to another woman, not his wife, and says, you know, where do you work out? You really look great. I'm telling you, that's not real advisable. I mean, first off, that he should have even made a comment to her of that type. Secondly, his wife's not going to be real happy that he even noticed it. You know, the idea, you can get emotionally involved, you can say things that are flirtatious, things that kind of feel that process out when you're doing that. And so there are signs that indicate that a friendship has crossed, according to Dr. Shirley Glass, and I think she identifies these fairly well. What are some signs that show that you have crossed that line? One is that emotional intimacy, sharing of information that I shouldn't be sharing. Secondly, sexual tension. How do you know when there is sexual tension between two people? How do you know when there's sexual tension? You may not know it between two other people. If you're one of the people, how do you know that there's sexual tension? Body language. The things that we say, the way we react when somebody comes into the room, what do we do? How do we act? What do we look like? All the body language that goes with that. Other things. I'm sorry, what? Yeah, there may be we don't know how to react. We don't know what to say. You feel the tension. Sometimes you say the tension is so thick you could cut it with a knife. We feel that uncomfortable feeling. We don't know how we should react to that person, what we ought to say to that person. You know, joking about improper kinds of things are sexual tension. Flirtation is sexual tension being released normally. Flirtation is that there's sexual tension. We're trying to break the tension somehow rather than just get rid of the sexual tension. It's important that we understand that the whole concept of that which is drawing us together, we've got to stop before we get drawn in. And that's a biblical concept we'll see in a minute. Thirdly, secrecy. You've stepped over the line when there's secrecy. When there's some woman other than my wife that knows something that my wife doesn't know. Now, I'm saying we're separating certain things, obviously. If I'm talking to one of my good friends and we're throwing a surprise party for my wife and he tells his wife that we're having a surprise party for my wife, that's not secrecy of the type we're talking about. But am I having communication with somebody that she's not knowing? Did I have a lunch with some woman that I didn't tell her about? Is there something that I'm sharing with somebody else that I'm not sharing with her? Am I receiving emails that she doesn't receive? I would tell you, as far as computers and such are concerned, my wife has access to everything on my computer, all my passwords. She can read all my emails. Nothing secretive on my computer. There's nothing that I'm wanting to hide or anything of that sort. We need to be completely open and transparent with one another. Secrecy, if there is secrecy, it means you've crossed the line. Here's that receipt. What'd you spend that money on? And he's not willing to tell you. And we're talking about, obviously, he didn't buy you a birthday present. You know, there's secrecy. People are hiding things. You've already crossed that line, no question. And then thirdly, physical involvement. That's where it goes next. And when there's physical involvement, almost impossible to turn around. Once an affair gets physical, it's like an addiction. That's why people get stuck in them. It literally is like an addiction. They don't even know how to break the relationship anymore once it's gotten physical. Why do you think that is? Yeah, I mean, so there's almost a rush that goes with that, a sense of accomplishment that goes with that, and it's like I am living these two lives. Other reasons. Why do you think it is so physically hard to break the sexual relationship? Do you ever think about that? It is always hard to take a step back. And there's fears that go with that as well, are there not? Fears of hurting the person, fears of them hurting you, fears of them making it public, there's a lot of things that cause people to stay trapped in there. But I would tell you there's a couple of reasons, and I think they are God-caused that makes it hard. And I don't want you to get the wrong impression of that. I'm not saying God causes you to have the relationship, but I'm saying God intended that the sexual relationship be pleasurable, and it is tough to walk away from anything that is pleasurable. It is pleasurable. Secondly, and more importantly than that, that is tied directly to that, God intended the sexual relationship to make one out of two. He intended that. And God said that happens whether it is your wife or it is not your wife, or your husband or not your husband. He didn't say you only become one with the person you have a right to become one with. He said, do you not know that whoever joins himself to a harlot becomes what? One with the harlot. He says there is a bond that God intended to be created in that relationship that is created. You can't stop that. That is a God-given bond because he intended it to be that. And it makes it extremely difficult to walk away from because in some sense of the word, you have become one with another person that you had no right to become one with. But it makes it very tough to walk away from it. So physical relationship, very tough to walk away from. And then finally, rationalization. This part amazes me. And as not just with this, some of the things we say to rationalize anything, you know, the idea of a good friend of mine who preaches was talking about his kids were playing in a room and the little girl started crying. And so they ran in there and they asked the little boy, what happened? And he says that they were playing and his sister bit herself, you know, which they thought was a little suspect to start with. And then when they went to inspect little sister, the teeth marks were on her nose. And so they were highly suspicious at that point. And so the little boy had rationalization for why he had done. You know, once my kids never, ever, I'd say, why did you hit your brother? Never do I remember my kids saying, you know, Dad, that was wrong. I am so sorry. I never should have hit my brother. I apologize for that. I won't do that again. I can't recall ever having asked them, why did you hit my brother, that they didn't have a reason. You remember that with your kids? If they got into a fight, they always had a reason. I hit him because, you know, the one kid says, because he hit me back. I thought, well, that's kind of a strange logic. He couldn't hit you back till you hit him first. Rationalization. What do we rationalize adulterous relationships? What kind of things have you heard people say? Why they stay in them? What kind of rationalizations for it? Boy, I tell you what, that's one that is tough right now because that gets, and I don't mean tough because it's tough to deal with biblically. It's easy to deal with biblically. God, I can tell you what God wants you to be. God wants you to be right. God, he says, because God wants me to be happy. I've had that presented to me on more than one occasion. Surely you think God wants me to be happy. I'll tell you what God wants you to be. God wants you to be faithful to your promise. God wants you to be, in fact, holy and wants you to be right with him. You'll be happy if you're all those things. You can count on it. You'll be content because that's what makes contentment. But that's one of the rationalizations. Surely God would want me to be happy. My mate didn't make me happy. I wouldn't do this if it wasn't for my mate. Do you think anybody blames it on their mate? It didn't take long for that to happen, did it? When's the first time that happened? Not with an adulterous relationship. How long did it take before mates were blaming mates? Didn't take Adam long, did it? This woman you stuck in my life, I was okay till you put her here. You know, she made me do this, and blaming God. Not only was it the woman, it's the woman you gave me. You know, the idea of blame happens very quick. It's a rationalization. People say she's just too, or I'm just too weak. One person said she truly needs me. I thought, well, there's a self-confident person. I wouldn't do this except they really need me in their life. You know, that kind of idea. How about the secrecy? Nobody else knows. There's no harm. We live in a society where two consenting adults seems to be the definition of our society, doesn't it? You know, it's just there's so many rationalizations. So if that's the pathology, if that's how it happens, then how do we keep it from happening? How do we prevent the affair from happening in our lives? I mean, you think about some of the things that transpired biblically. Let's look at a couple of different cases. One on a positive note to start with. Joseph. What a great story, isn't it? I mean, Joseph, you think about putting yourself in Joseph's shoes. You think that was easy? The king, the ruler of the land's wife. You know, this one who is you know, in a governorship, his wife is making passes at you and trying to come on to you and she's just, you know, saying, look, nobody's gonna know. My husband's gone. And so she's gonna try and make this pass. And Joseph does what? Man, he runs as fast as he can, doesn't he? Leaves his coat behind. I don't care. I'm getting out of Dodge. That's his attitude. I'm getting away from this. Totally different than some others in the Bible, though, isn't it? What about David? David and Bathsheba. such a terrible occurrence that Nathan tells an absolutely tragic story when he's recounting that to David, doesn't he? He says, let me tell you about a guy that had everything in the world and went and stole another man's lamb who was his pet, who was like a child to him. He had everything. This man had only one. It ate at the dinner table with him. They had it in their house. They called it by name. It was just this wonderful relationship with their one little ewe lamb they had. So much so that you get in the picture, the man wouldn't have killed that lamb himself to eat it, would he? In that story. I think he's saying this man wasn't saving it for his own table. They weren't going to eat this lamb themselves either, and somebody stole it. Man, and David is just, he's hot, isn't he? This man is worthy of death. Somebody ought to put this man to death. How can he possibly do that? And Nathan says, you are that man. I mean, that's a story. Well, how'd that happen? Tell me some of the things David did wrong that show you he followed in this pathology that we talked about. He wasn't with his army. That's where it started, wasn't it? It wasn't coincidence that God said it was a time when kings were at war. That's not coincidence. That's God saying, here's where David should have been. Here's where David was. He was in the wrong place. That puts him automatically in a more vulnerable situation, doesn't it? So then what happens? What? He saw her, you say, or he stole her? He did both. Yeah, all right, he saw her first. Yeah, and so now let's give David the benefit of the doubt. All right, let's put him on the rooftop in an innocent manner. We don't know, it doesn't tell us why he was up there. It wasn't like it says David went up to spy and see if he could find any women. But he saw her while he's up there. So even if you give him the benefit of the doubt and say, David saw something he shouldn't have seen while he was up there. Let me ask you this. Have you ever seen anything of a sexual nature that you wish you hadn't seen? He could have. You can't prevent that entirely, can you? We're walking down the mall one time, and some girl decides that she's going to hike her shirt up and flash to everybody else in the mall. Well, we didn't ask for that. Didn't want that. Wasn't pleased by that, but there was nothing I couldn't take my steps back in time and say, I'm going to do something so I didn't see it. But how you react to that can be changed, can it? That can be altered. David, it says, beheld her. He looked upon her. He gazed is the idea. As we had talked about, men are physically driven, physically attracted, visually attracted. And so he looked and he gazed. He thought, wow, she is a gorgeous woman. So he's looking on her. What else happens? He sends for her. First he inquired, though, didn't he? He sent somebody and said, who is this woman? I saw this woman on the roof the other day. Who is this woman? What'd they say to him? He says, this is Uriah's wife, didn't he? Yeah, so this is Uriah's wife. Surely this is the wife of Uriah the Hittite. So David said, whoa, I'm done with that. Get out of this situation. He didn't do that, did he? He sent for her anyway. And then we know all the things that happen. He sins for her. He ends up sleeping with her. He commits conspiracy to murder and is accused of murder. There's all these things that happen in his life, all because of that. It says that he lay with her and, you know, all those things transpired, all because David allowed himself to walk down that path. Well, turn to Proverbs chapter 7. That's where we want to take the rest of our time this afternoon. Proverbs chapter 7, because I'm telling you, here is, in fact, the picture of that vulnerability and slipping into that trap and the picture of how to get, or to not to get out of it, but how to avoid it, because that's what we want to make sure that we're doing. Proverbs chapter 7. Read with me if you would, starting in verse 6. For at the window of my house, I looked through my lattice and I saw among the simple. I perceived among the youths a man devoid of understanding passing along the street near her corner. He took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him. With an impudent face, she said to him, I have peace offerings with me. Today I've paid my vows. So I came out to meet you diligently to seek your face, and I have found you. I have spread my bed with tapestry, colored coverings of Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He's taken a bag of money with him and will come home late on the appointed day. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver. As a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. Is that not the picture that we described of the pathology? Tell me where he fell short. What happened in this young man's life? Where do you see him going awry? He was where he shouldn't have been. No question about that. He was walking where he shouldn't have been walking. He was in the section of town where he shouldn't have been. And not only was he in the section of town, when was he there? Why was he there at night? Absolutely. That's the secrecy, to keep from being seen by anyone. Why are most crimes committed at night? You know, it's because you can sneak about. That's not without cause. And so there's a secrecy involved here. There's a vulnerability right off the bat. What does it say about this man? He was what? He was void of understanding. This man was simple. He didn't know what he should be doing, what he shouldn't be doing. Why? Could he have corrected that? He could have corrected that. That's a correctable thing. He could learn what was right and what was wrong. How important is it that we make sure we understand what God wants out of us, that we read what he tells us to be? I've got a sermon that the first line of the sermon is, "My wife is ignorant." And that doesn't always set real well with her when I preach that sermon, but I'm ignorant too. Ignorance isn't a bad thing in the sense of that it's uncorrectable. Now, if I'm foolish, that's a different thing. Foolish is having a knowledge and not doing anything about it. But my wife is ignorant about, say, cars. I'm ignorant of many things. But I can correct a lot of those. I can study and get knowledge. This man was void of understanding. Many people are void of understanding, but they can get that understanding. They can get the knowledge from God and even seeking the wisdom from God. He says he'll give that to us freely if we'll ask. That's an attainable thing. But this man, he didn't have that. And so he goes out there. Literally, it's saying that he lacked judgment. He goes to this woman's house at night. How is she dressed? What is it that he's exposed himself to? The attire of a harlot. You think that wasn't noticeable to him? You know, who are we kidding when we say that the way people dress and what we watch in the movies and what we see on TV doesn't affect us? Are we kidding? Do we honestly think we can sell that package to somebody? That we can look at people in states of all kinds of undress and it has no effect on us? It doesn't work. God understands that you see certain things, it automatically creates that vulnerability. Her body language is crafty. She grabs him and kisses him. You talk about a bold move. It's going to be tough to overcome that. She offers him a meal. So now they're dealing with the pleasure. She offers him secrecy, doesn't she? He's not going to come home for a while. Nobody knows that we're going to be doing this. We can be in there. She offers herself. All of a sudden he follows her. He's stuck. Well, God tells him, or tells us, how you prevent that in the following verses. He says, first, guard your heart. In verse 25, he says, do not let your heart turn to her ways. Martin Luther reportedly said, you can't keep the birds from flying over your head, but you can keep them from nesting in your hair. You've got to decide what you're going to do with life. How it is that I'm going to guard my heart. How it is that I'm going to protect myself. It is important to make sure that I know what my goal is and how I'm going to accomplish that goal to begin with. Job, in Job chapter 31, makes a great statement. Such a great statement, I had a friend of mine that posted this statement on his television set. Job said that, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why should I look upon a young woman? Job says, I've already decided what I'm going to watch and what I'm not going to watch. I've made a covenant with my eyes. I would tell you Christians need to be more selective in what they choose for entertainment because it is affecting the way we view things and what we think about things. We need to be selective about what we allow ourselves to see, what we allow ourselves to hear. We need to be careful because there is a danger that is associated with that because God has told us there's a danger with that. So much so that Jesus said, I'm not interested only in you not committing adultery. Jesus said, what I'm interested in is that you need to do what? Not even what? You need not even to look. He says, because when you look upon her, you've lusted already in your heart. You have already committed that adultery in your heart. He said, when the heart goes that direction, you're already stuck. There is already problems. That, how are you going to keep that? When David saw Bathsheba, had he immediately averted his eyes and gone and concentrated on his relationship with God, you think it would have changed things? Would have been different, wouldn't it? You know, how many times have we watched something? Maybe something comes on, we watch it, and we think, well, it's going to get better. And so we watch it some longer, or we listen to it longer, or whatever the case may be. Avert yourself immediately. Guard your heart. Just decide, I'm not going to do this. I need to know whether or not I'm vulnerable or not. I need to know what kind of situations are going to present me a problem. I need to guard my heart. What is it that's going to break down my heart? Maybe I'm a particularly sympathetic kind of person, and I know that if I get around people and I'm around a woman who's struggling and having trouble in her family and marriage, I'm the kind of person that may want to console her. That makes me more vulnerable. If I know that about myself, guard my heart. Don't put yourself in that position. Understand you may have to take some of those kinds of steps. We need to, as Paul told the Corinthians, bring every thought into captivity. How hard is that? You ever seen an image or heard a word or a phrase or something else that has come back to your mind by way of memory that you didn't want to come back? The image flashed up again, or the thought flashed up again in your mind, the word that you heard flashed up again, whatever the case may be. It is tough to bring every thought captive, isn't it? So that I can fully control my thoughts. It's so tough that I better concentrate a real effort on that. I need to guard my heart. But the second step that goes directly along with that is, in fact, that I need to watch my step. Not only my heart. He says, do not, in verse 25 again, he says, do not stray into her paths. Don't go where she is. Making sure that you're taking care of. Now that I've got my heart is that goal, that plan that we talked about. Now I've got to talk about how am I going to execute that in my life? What am I going to put in place? One man said he chose to drive a different way to work every day. I thought, that's a strange thing. How would that help? He said, because the way I used to go to work, I had to drive right by a place where it was a bar where there were striptease and things of that nature, and there would regularly be women standing outside, and obviously they couldn't stand outside undressed, or at least not completely, but they would stand outside and try and wave patrons in, that kind of thing. He said, I didn't want to look at that every day. It wasn't that he was tempted at that point, but he said, why would I drive by there and subject myself to that? So he changed the way he drove to work. I thought, that's an interesting concept. That's the idea of planting hedges around yourself. Anybody in here ever read the book by Jerry Jenkins called Hedges, Loving Your Marriage Enough to Protect It? Three hands, four hands, five hands, six hands, seven hands. Oh, good. That may be the most, that's over a dozen for sure. That's the most I've had any place I've ever been, I would tell you. I would tell you this, for sure, men, every man needs to get a copy of that book and read it. I believe that. Every man, Christian man, needs to get a copy of that book and read that. It talks about how to put hedges around your marriage to keep you from doing the things that you should not do. It may, in fact, mean you've got to change the television programs you watch, the movies you go to, the music you listen to, the traffic routes you take, what friends you spend time with. It may affect a lot of things as you're starting to plant hedges around your life. Where do you think the two most prominent problems regarding adulterous relationships? They come from what two sources, do you think? Workplace is first. Well, and after hours is certainly probably where they meet. Boy, that would be sad, though, wouldn't it? That's too prominent. There's no question about that. In our society, it is now, the number two is now the Internet. The workplace and the Internet. People who meet other people on the Internet. People who have had contact, and so they hook up. We see that regularly, do we not? I mean, how many times do they do stings about those kinds of things just dealing with children pornography issues and trying to have relationships with children? If that's the case between children, which they're actually checking and arresting people, how much do you think is going on between adults that's out there? It is now the number two, the workplace and the Internet. We're going to have to plant some hedges around ourselves to protect ourselves in that way. I know when I first started preaching, Buddy Payne came up to me and said, let me give you a piece of advice. He says, don't ever study with a woman by herself, period. I have to tell you, I thought, well, that's kind of strange. And my first thought was, Buddy doesn't trust me very much. That was my first thought. I was a young preacher, probably more brash than I should have been, certainly more selfish than I should have been, way more confident than I should have been. And so I thought, well, he doesn't trust me very much, but I felt kind of like the disciples in the boat. I was a new Christian, relatively. And I felt like the disciples in the boat when Jesus said, put the net down on that side. You know, and the disciples were thinking, yeah, you're a carpenter. We're fishermen. We've been out here all night. We're telling you there's no fish down there, but we'll do it because you said to do it. That was what they pretty much told Jesus. That's what I did. I said, you know what? Because Buddy said it, I will make that a part of my preaching life. And so from day one, refused to study with a woman alone. You can't imagine how thankful I am because I've got preacher friends and ones that I know of who have fallen and succumbed to exactly that problem, who have found themselves consoling somebody, studying with somebody alone, crying on each other's shoulder, becoming vulnerable, and ending up in an adulterous relationship. I would tell you, if you can help it, don't ever be alone with somebody the opposite sex other than your wife. Ever. If you can avoid it. You can't always avoid that. It may be that you have to. If you have to, try to make sure that it is completely open and public. Call your spouse and say, I've got to meet this person for lunch today. We're going to be at such and such restaurant. Ask your spouse to come along. Say, you know what, you can't sit with us because we're having a business luncheon, but I'd love to see you sitting over in the corner of the restaurant where I can see your beautiful face while I'm having this meeting. You think she won't feel secure about that? My husband wants me to know that he's there, but he wants me to know nothing's going on. He wants me to see nothing's going on, everything open. You've got to make arrangements. If you're taking business trips, you do everything you can to avoid singular contact on those business trips. Traveling together, whatever else the case may be. Try to meet in groups if at all possible. We need to avoid cordial and touching, and we're in too much of a touchy-feely society right now. I've got a good friend that was involved in an adulterous relationship multiple times over a long period of time, who's marriage is now severed. Christian. And he was a touchy-feely kind of person. One of those people that we call an over-under shaker. You ever meet those people? Reach out, shake your hand. When you take their hand, they turn their hand over this way, put their other hand on top, and he would stand there. And if he's shaking hands with a woman, he'd hold hands with a woman like that for several minutes while they talk. That's a bad idea. You don't need that kind of contact. Or walking up to somebody that's not your spouse, putting your hand on their, rubbing their back while you're talking to them. I've seen that happen. There's that kind of feeling. You know, somebody that puts their hand on you in some kind of semi-intimate way. That may not be their intent. I understand that. The question is, if the other person's vulnerable, you don't know how they're interpreting it. There's so many things. If you're going to hug somebody because you haven't seen them in a while, that's one thing. But how do you embrace? You know, what is that touching accomplishing? We need to make sure that we're not taking that over the level. We need to set some hedges around ourselves. Don't be afraid to set up those emotional walls around ourselves. We need, in fact, to do that. Two key passages that come to mind when I think about either one of these things. One, do not give Satan an opportunity. That's what Paul said to the Ephesians. Don't give him a beachhead. Don't let him get his foot in the door because you're going to have a problem. Whether it's at work or the internet. I would tell you, the internet, you think that's not a huge problem? I was counseling in 7 marriages about 3 years ago. 7 marriages simultaneously that I was counseling in which the internet and pornography on the internet was instrumental in 5 of those marriages. These are all Christians. They didn't all worship with me, but these were 7 marriages in which 5 were involved in internet pornography. You think that's not prevalent among brethren? I would tell you, you're sadly mistaken. It is rampant among even our brethren, and it is tearing families apart. It is because it is secret, because it is accessible, and we just think we can get away with that. Smut is available at a level that has never been available before. There is no question about that. You can gain access to the absolutely most raunchy pictures that could possibly be portrayed in the world, and your kids can get access to those. There's just so many things that are available. We need to make sure we're protecting. How many people in here have internet access who also have a strong internet filter, just the internet filter? I would tell you, get an internet filter, especially if you have kids at home. Get an internet filter. It blocks. There's a good filter called Be Safe. It's from the American Family Association. You can get it by going to besafe.com. It'll make some things more inconvenient for you. I can't do Google Images. You know how if you type in a search for something on Google, and at the top it'll say, it gives you different choices. One of them is images. If I click on images, it says blocked. I have to actually go to the websites that have the images to make sure that they're decent, and it will either block the website or not. It's updated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they continue to do that. It's about $69 a year to put that on your computer that will allow you to put it on up to 3 computers. It's a really, really good system. It blocks all gambling sites, not just pornography. You know, I've got a Juno email account, and when I go to Juno, Juno does not advertise pornographic sites. They do advertise gambling sites, you know, the poker.com, that kind of stuff. And so when my Juno account pops up, I get these bars that says, blocked, blocked, blocked. The ads won't come up. It won't let an ad come up that's trying to get me to go to an internet gambling site. So it blocks all those. It is a good system. It's very protected. You can set it up so that you can't disable it yourself. Mine is set up for, and I gave my wife she set the password for it, just so that she would know I'm not doing anything with it. Not because I was afraid so much, even though I'm concerned about that. I don't want to go that direction. But I gave her the opportunity. You set the password. You disable it so that I can't get in now and turn it off if I want to turn it off. Sometimes that's a good idea, sometimes it's not. She forgot the password, lost the paper that it was written down on, so I have no idea now if we need to disable it, how to disable it. But that's okay. I can't get onto the sites that I shouldn't be getting onto anyway. What difference does it make? You need to put some kind of protection. Don't have the computer somewhere that there can be secrecy. I've got a family member that came home from school every day. This was his standard pattern in high school. Came home from school every day, went into his bedroom, closed the door, got on the internet. You want to talk about just a formula for extreme issues and problems in life? You know, I got to tell you, if that's my son, 2 things happen. 1, the computer comes out of the room. Secondly, the door comes off the hinges. You're not locking the door in my house to lock me out of your bedroom. My house, my bedroom, I'm letting you sleep in it. That's my attitude anyway. If you want that much privacy, then you need to eventually move out of my house. So, you know, I'm not going to let my child have access to internet in their bedroom. Terrible idea. There's no reason that your child has to have access to internet in their bedroom. They need to have access to the internet where you can see everything that they're doing. Same way husbands and wives ought to be able to see what the other one is doing. We need to provide a way of escape. Mark Twain said, there are several good protections against temptation. The surest is cowardice. I love that quote. I love that quote. A lot of ways to avoid it, but he says the best way is just to turn your tail and run. That's good. We need to be cowards in some sense. Thirdly, consider the cost. Verse 26 says, many are the victims she has brought down. Her slain are a mighty throng. Her house is a highway to the grave, leading down to the chambers of death. Or in Proverbs chapter 6, verse 27 and 29, it says, can a man scoop fire into his lap without his clothes being burned, without his feet being scorched? So is he who sleeps with another man's wife. No one who touches her will go unpunished. Understand the consequences. Some of my favorite commercials on TV are consequential commercials. Have you ever seen those? Some of them are tough to watch. Tough to watch. I remember one in particular. You remember it with a little girl on a tire swing out in front of the house? She looks like she's maybe 3 or 4 years old. She's swinging on a tire swing, and it's such a pretty scene. And the next thing you see is the tire swing is swinging. It has no child on it. It says, killed by a drunk driver, and gives you a date. Man, that's tough, but I'll tell you, anybody that wants to take a drink and get behind a wheel needs to see that. You need to understand, there is a cost involved with bad behavior. If you had sat David down, because David was described by God as what kind of man? A man after God's own heart. So he fouled up big time, didn't he? No question about that. He fouled up, but David had a good heart at least, didn't he? People with good hearts make mistakes, and even bad mistakes. But if you'd have sat David down and said, David, let me talk to you. There's this woman, Bathsheba, and I'm telling you, she is drop-dead gorgeous. She is one of the most stunning women you will ever see in your life, and you can have her. And all it's going to cost you is the death of your son, the division of your family, the death of other family members because of their pursuit for one another, and the way they want to overtake one another. And it's going to cause you this turmoil for this amount of years in your life. But you can have her, David, if you want her. You just tell me, if you had presented the case to David that way, what do you anticipate David would have said? You think David would have said, I think that's worth it. I don't think so. I think a man after God's own heart probably, had he truly considered the cost, would have made the right choice. He didn't consider the cost. He didn't think about the damage. The same as husbands and wives aren't thinking about the damage today when they think about kids and the amount of destruction that it brings into the kids' lives, the amount of emotional destruction that it brings into their spouse's life. Even marriages that don't end in divorce will spend years and years with trust issues within that marriage. It becomes difficult. The cost is incredible. God says you can't scoop fire into your lap and think you're not going to get burned. There is a cost to be paid. And I would tell you that the cost is greater than we think sometimes, because the number one thing David was faulted for was what? God told David, you will lose your son for what reason? Do you remember? There was a because in that statement. Said, because you have given occasion to the enemy. Not because you violated this woman's marriage. Not even because you've killed her husband. But because you have shamed God. You've given an occasion to the enemy to point at God. And he says, that is the nature of an adulterous relationship in the life of a child of God. It isn't only us that hurts. We hurt God when that's the way we behave. It says you've given occasion to the enemy to blaspheme God. That's tough. We need to make sure that we're not doing that. One preacher in a large congregation puts on his desk these three things. He has a picture of his family, a picture of the church family and the facility, and a newspaper article of a well-known preacher who had an adulterous relationship. He keeps those three items on his desk at all times to remind him of the consequences should he ever decide to take that step himself. I thought that's actually a pretty cool hedge. Here's somebody who said, I'm putting all this stuff out there. You think you may not need hedges. I had one man come up to me after a service, after we did this seminar at one location. He said, that's way overboard. I'm just telling you, that's way overboard. I'm committed that I'm not going to do that, and I don't need to put those hedges around my marriage. That's overboard. That's as if we don't have any trust for each other at all. And I didn't even get a chance to say a word. Another guy who, in fact, was a deacon in the Lord's body at a different location previously, had in fact had an adulterous relationship when he never thought that he would. And he walked up, and while we were still talking, that man made that statement. He walked up and he looked at the other guy, and they knew each other. And all he said was, I would have fallen asleep with the other disciples. I thought, that's an interesting comment. He's saying, you know, it's easy to say, I'd never do that. He says, but when the Lord said, watch and pray, he said, I know that the flesh is weak, even though the mind is willing. I know the flesh is weak. And had those disciples been on their knees praying, they would have been less likely to fall asleep than had they been sitting down resting. Do you not believe that? They hadn't put into place. Jesus prayed without falling asleep. It was that important to him. He says, I would have fallen asleep with the other disciples. He's just saying, our flesh is weak. My mind is made up, but I'm telling you, it takes more than just making up your mind. You better put something in place to stop it. As soon as he said that, he says, and sadder yet, I would have denied the Lord with Peter. It wasn't just Peter. They all deserted the Lord. Why? Because the spirit, the mind is willing, the flesh is weak. People, we better accept that. We better put something in place to protect it. That's why Romans says that you need not to make a provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. Why should kids who aren't married stay out of parked cars in dark places or out of houses where there is no adult supervision? Because all they're doing is providing an opportunity for the fulfillment of the flesh. Don't do it. Put those hedges in place. And then finally, keep the home fires burning. Keep the home fires burning. Proverbs 5 says, drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. What great verses. If I do everything I can as a male, and the women do the same thing in reverse, if I'm doing everything I can to understand and appreciate that I am married to the best, most wonderful, most beautiful person in the world, where is the desire to go outside that relationship? He said, Do everything you can to focus on making this one right. Put your effort into this. That will help keep you from straying over here. I think that's absolutely true. Keep the home fires burning. Keep that alive. Let that love grow every single day. That's what these marriage seminars are all about. How do I help my love grow stronger every single day? Nothing will help more than trying to become the godly husband that God wants me to become. If I'm striving with all my might to love my wife with every ounce of energy I've got, I'm not going to have time to dedicate to some other person in that same fashion. He says, let you concentrate your information or your efforts right there for the husbands and for the wives. Thanks so much for your attention. I told you three. I was wrong. 10 after, so that's not terrible. It could be worse. I do appreciate your attention. I know these kind of Saturdays are long. That's why we like to do them in the morning. And early in the afternoon, you get the rest of the evening kind of relaxing and taking time. After, are you going to...